Well, it's good to continue on a great series and start by reading the beginning of the section on the armor of God, and we'll read about this week's topic, which is the belt of truth. So if you want to turn and follow, we're reading from Ephesians chapter 6. And verses 11 to 18. It says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you might be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers over this present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you might be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all to stand firm, stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth." And then if we just move to the very end of that section, it finishes by saying, "Pray at all times in the Spirit with all prayer and supplication." And so what we have then is the context for what we're talking about. We've already talked about the helmet of salvation. We've already talked about the shield of faith. And in every series, there's always a little bit of a discussion about what should come first. Where should we start? And Luke has very sensibly introduced the series with strong teaching about the protection of our mind and about the way that we use faith. But in one way, I'm starting over again. And I'm starting over simply because the belt is the very first part of the armor that Paul talks about. And secondly, when a soldier, and you don't quite get it in the reading that we did in the English Standard Version, but if you read it in the Amplified Version, it talks about the armor of a heavenly armored soldier. And in the context of that, it was Roman armor. So although at the time, obviously, there was the Jewish army, and the Jewish army looked different to the Roman army. They carried different types of shields and different types of armor. Paul, of course, was a Roman citizen from Tarsus. And the description that he's got is that of a Roman soldier. And so when you looked at the Roman soldier, what happened is that they'd have to put the belt on first. Before everything else, it was the belt. And it's interesting that that's where we're starting today, with the idea of basics. And the basics is, it's the belt of truth. Now, I've got a private little bet with myself. It's not a real bet, because I'm not betting anything, if you're with me, but it's a little game I've played. And it is that everybody will walk away with something from this morning's sermon. All right? Unfortunately, it's probably the thing that's the least important, but I'm sure you're going to smile, because the first type of belt that we can talk about was actually the baldric. Do you know what baldric is? See, I knew you'd say Blackadder. The baldric actually is the strap that goes around the shoulder and down diagonally. And that was the first part of it, but the other part was the belteus, or baltius, which was the type that goes around. And in the Bible reading, it says, "Girding your loins." The word for loin in this case isn't the bit further south, but it's the hip, right? So it's that belt that goes around the hips. And the importance of that belt is everything really that's useful hangs from it. So I'm sure you'll go away remembering one thing, what baldric really means. Clever word, wasn't it, really, for them to use for the shore? Because it's the strap that supports everything. You get the context for it. So hang on. What the Roman soldier would hang from it is a gladius, which was a sword. They would also hang the pugio, which is the dagger, and they would also hang the loculus, which was basically pouches. That's off a recreation thingy, you know, chaps who dress up at weekends. But you'll see there that that's the sort of makeup of the way that the way it used to look. Now, some things are quite important out of this that perhaps isn't immediately obvious. The first thing is that the baltius, that belt, was actually the mark of a soldier. And not only that, it was the status symbol of the soldier as well. And it was worn at all times, not all the bits on it, but it was worn at all times, even off duty. Right? Next, only soldiers were allowed to wear that belt. If you were wearing a belt like that and you weren't a soldier, you were breaking the law. So I'm sure we could pull some spiritual points out of that about wearing it at all times. And I'm sure we could talk about, you know, the necessity to have it if we are a soldier of Christ. But I'll skate past those points. You can draw out the consequences of that yourself. It's interesting how much we don't know about this belt, in fairness, because it might suggest some type of rank outside the formal ranking system. We don't really know. We do know that all the dangly bits, if you like, were very ornate, and quite often they would have jewels in them, and they were intricate, and they were... people don't really know why. But the suspicion by the historians is this. The Roman soldiers didn't have a lot of ways to spend their money, because all the bed and board and everything's provided for them. So basically the suggestion is that Roman soldiers would decorate these, as if you like, maybe from different campaigns, maybe the equivalent of medals, or it might just be a bit of Roman bling, right? But that's the belt that Paul is referring to. Now, something else that's worth mentioning along the way, and I know we know this, but it's one of those formal things that's worth saying every now and again. Paul, although he's using the language of a soldier and implements of violence, if you like, there is no link to real fighting. Do you understand? The idea of real fighting for Christians is a no-no. What we have here, and it's great because Paul labels every one of them the helmet of salvation, the shield of faith, the sword of the Spirit. Now, it's important to say that, especially in this day and age where some religions perhaps contain a lot of talk about fighting. There's none of that here. There's none of that. This is a spiritual fight, and only a spiritual fight. So it is the belt of what? It is the belt of... that half of the congregation were willing to take part. It is the belt of... thank you. That's good. Truth isn't particularly highly regarded today. Have you noticed? Truth is a great casualty of our world. Just before Christmas, but a wee bit before that, we bought a house for our son, or we helped him buy a house, and the day we bought it, somebody nicked lead off the roof. Wasn't that nice of them? Three young men in the middle of the night decide to climb up, nick the lead, roll it into a ball, hide it around the corner in the bushes. So I went down there at sort of 9:15. One of the neighbors says, we saw them do it, and we think they've hidden it around the corner. We went around the corner in the bushes. There's the lead. So we ring the police back. Before the police came out, a car came down the street. Now, this was a very distinctive car. It was a white Chevy with red wheels, a red bumper, and red door mirrors, right? And a neighbor took a photograph of it and got the license plate. And then the young men from the car got out, walked to the bushes, picked up the lead, came straight back, put it in the car, and drove off, went to the scrapyard. So I ring all this into the police and give them all the details. The police go to the young men concerned and the man that owns the car, and they say, we've got your car, we've got your own photograph, and you're involved. It wasn't me. It wasn't me. It's not my car. I wonder how many white Chevys with red wheels and red bumpers and red door mirrors there are in the country. There's probably one of them. And strangely enough, it was the same license plate as this man. It's not mine. And they got the kid who climbed up and got him, and he said, well, it wasn't me. Now, we expect that in a sense, don't we? Shane's smiling because it brings back memories of no doubt. But in universities, truths become a casualty there too. There's now what they call safe spaces for students. Do you know what a safe space is? A safe space is where no one's allowed to challenge anything that anybody says or believes. Unless they're Christians, you can challenge that. So in other words, truth doesn't become... Somebody can say something outrageous. But if you challenge it, not just a safe space, you can't challenge it. And what happened is, truth has become described as your truth or my truth. But you know, Christians believe in real truth. And this belt of truth is important. I know there were spin doctors before Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson, but they elevated it to a new art. Now we've become infatuated with the idea of fake news, as if it's a recent invention. The Daily Sport regularly, if you go back 25 years actually, they were doing missing plane found on the moon. This is the latest plane that's crashed that they've now said is found on the moon. And if you go to the next one, we'll have monkey lands plane, a picture of a pilot asleep and a monkey at the wheel. Wheel of the plane? Do you have a wheel on a plane? Is it? Anyhow, monkey flying the plane. Clearly not real. And then if you've got the next one, you've got statue of Elvis found on Mars. And this is 25-year-old. And of course, the famous one that Max Clifford, the publicist, who's recently died in prison. Freddie Starr's career was taking a nosedive. And he went to Max Clifford and said, how can we resurrect my career? And he put this out as a news story. Can you believe it? And they printed it in the Sun. And it was, model says, he put a live pet in a sandwich and ate it. Complete nonsense. Never happened. But he wanted Freddie Starr's career to be kickstarted again. This guy's mad. He's so crazy, he ate a hamster. Well, you know, we believe in real truth. And it struck me that when we start talking about real truth, we need to start talking about big picture. And the reason we need to talk about the big picture is we can get so caught up in everyday life, we forget the real truths. You see, I believe in the real truth, and God either exists or he doesn't exist. Is that fair? There isn't really any halfway ground, is there? And I can respect people's positions. If they say God doesn't exist, I can absolutely respect that. I don't agree with them. I believe in God. And I believe God is real. But at least I can respect that. What I can't respect is the liberal theologians, the liberal ministers, who almost take this view, well, God doesn't exist, but it's worth having religion. Do you know what I mean? I've got faith in faith. You know, I believe that we need to nail our colours to the mast. We need to act and believe with consequence. In other words, if what we believe is true, then we must live by it. And if it isn't true, walk out of here this morning and don't come back. Do you understand? We shouldn't kid ourselves. We must either be disciples or enemies of the faith, because there's no honest position in the middle. If God exists, if Jesus is real, then it is the biggest thing. Not part of our life, but all of our life. If Jesus died for my sins, then Jesus cannot be put in a box for Sundays and brought out then and ignored the rest of the week. We either committed to dying for the faith or pledged to its destruction. And I mean that. Because we believe in truth. And Paul starts off this introduction to the armor of God with a great truth. And sometimes we skate by it because we're thinking about the armor. But before he gets to the armor, he says, therefore. And anytime you read a therefore, you have to read before. Yeah? For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against authorities, against cosmic powers of this present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. Therefore, take on the whole armor of God. Wow, that's a big truth. Can I say it again? We probably don't live like that. We probably wake up in the morning and stretch, toddle off to the loo, have breakfast. Not in the loo, you come back first. Plan your day, or maybe you're dashing out to work. But actually, that day is yet another day of being caught up in this big truth. And this big truth, there is a war raging around us. And we are part of that war. You know, we love stories. And stories have a great resonance with us. They echo somehow in our soul, don't they? We love stories. That might be that you... How many people love reading novels? Some of you don't. Some of you don't read novels. I'm shocked. We love films. How many people don't watch films? We love video games. Oh, hang on, you're Christians, aren't you? Yeah, you probably don't look at video games. Something tainted about video games. It's a joke. Not a good one, clearly, but it was an attempt. We seem to be hooked on stories. In stories, there's always a hero. No, I don't mean hero as in man or a woman. You know what I mean? It's non-gendered. But there's always a hero. There's always somebody. And usually, they don't really know who they are. They don't really know why they're there. But then this great adventure starts where they become caught up in this enormous adventure. Once upon a time, in a galaxy far, far away. Dun, dun, dun. It's the wrong music. I nearly went into Superman. I can't remember them properly, so never mind. But you see, I think this is quite important. There's some yearning inside us that identifies with this idea of a hero. You see, we're born into a world, and by nature the child is ignorant of its surroundings. A baby cannot comprehend the size of the house it's living in, never mind the town or the city or the country. A babe in arms can't comprehend of classical music or pop music. Can't comprehend of anything other than wanting to be fed, wanting to sleep, and wanting to be clean. Yeah? If it doesn't get those things, it'll cry. But that's the nature of a child. They're born into ignorance. And then slowly they learn about family. They learn about their hometown. They learn about their nation. And then as we leave childhood, it becomes a shock. Because we start to learn that not everything is wonderful. We find that our parents or our grandparents may have made incredible mistakes in their life. We might learn that our hometown has been built by greedy businessmen and corrupt politicians. We grow and we suddenly learn that our nation might have been involved in disgraceful things in the past. We learn these things slowly and they come to us as disappointments. Now, of course, for some, childhood itself is a living nightmare and they've got no illusions about the world. And we find that all the myths of childhood somehow end up turning to sand. I'm not a fan of Walt Disney. I'm not a fan of Disney at all. Somehow, we tell our children, one day their prince will come. One day love's true first kiss. Will transform their lives and the perfect partner. There is only one person in this world for you. Only one. Your true love. And of course, it's a fairy tale. Now, I mean, in fairness, I have fallen in love with my lovely wife. And it's a very interesting thing, and it's a very fortunate thing that she happened only to live about 10 miles away. Because if I believed Disney, she could live anywhere in the world. What would I have done if she lived in China? And we never had met. I'm joking, but you get it. We tell stories and myths, and then we wonder why people become heartbroken when they realize the fables aren't true. The fact is that marriage is far more wonderful than there's only one person alive who's your perfect partner. Marriage is far more wonderful than that, but it requires far more work. And so for some, love becomes an illusion. Their childhood dreams of a perfect life ahead, when they start school and get serious about it and start to think, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a pilot. I'm going to be this and I'm going to be that. And then they find that life intrudes. And there's very few people in life get the job that they've always wanted. And guess what? Those that do somehow find that it wasn't what they expected it to be. Everybody seems to grow up understanding that the world isn't supposed to be like this. Does that make sense? Talk to people. They all, underneath everything, seem to have this great yearning for this great story that they see reflected and refracted in all these other stories that we tell ourselves. Do you get me? Seems as if we yearn for the real story, the real thing. And then, we discover a great truth. Not as the world, not as it's meant to be, but we learn that it's our selfishness that has ruined it. And that of all our fathers as well. And greater than any story in any movie or any novel, if we open to it, we can also discover that we are truly loved by God. And if we are prepared to come to that God, we can be involved in this greatest of stories that leaves Star Wars far behind, that kicks Superman into touch. A greater love affair than any erotic story anywhere. Because the story here is built upon love that lets someone give up their life, even for those who are busy crucifying them. This is the truth. This is where we are. You know, there's an obsession sometimes that people have about finding themselves. Have you heard anybody say, "I wish I could find myself"? And I need to take a break because I need to find myself. I don't know if anybody watches The Americans, a TV series about two Russian spies living in America in the 1980s. And they're undercover all the time, living in a hostile world, but they've got a mission, you know? And I always laugh when I see it because it seems so relevant in some ways to the way we are. We are the resistance fighters in this world. We are the undercover agents. The agents of darkness are all around us, but we are the ones living the secret life, if you like, to undermine the enemy. But in there, one of the guys goes off to this self-help guru thing because he's having problems. And he goes there to find out, who am I? He's trying to find his real identity. Let me tell you, the Bible tells you how you can find yourself. But it's a bit different to what you might expect. The truth is that the more you resist God and try to live on your own, the more you become dominated by your own hereditary and upbringing and your surroundings and your natural desires. In fact, the myself we all think of is often just a meeting place for a train of events and accidents which you never started and can't stop. My wishes simply are desires thrown up by my physical frame or pumped into me by other men's thoughts or even suggested to me by spiritual forces that oppose us. Do you understand? That is the nature of our personality and being. And when we say we want to find ourselves, we have to mean more than that. The real reason I hold my political views is because I've been at the receiving end of propaganda. I'm not in my natural state so much of a person that I like to believe. But when I turn to Christ, when I give myself up to his personality, then I begin to have a real personality of my own. And until you've given up yourself to him, you will not have a real self. You might say, "I want to find myself," but every road that leads off from there becomes a dead end. Sameness is to be found in most natural men, but not those who surrender to Christ. And there must be a real giving up of self. To find yourself, Jesus says, you must lose it. You must throw away blindly, so to speak, everything of your own And Christ will give you a real personality. No, you mustn't go to him for that, because that just is an indication that you're thinking wrong. But the first step is to stop thinking about yourself altogether. And your real self, your new self, won't come to you as long as you're looking for it. It'll come to you when you are looking to him. Does that sound strange? Well, I suppose the principle holds true in social life. You'll never make a good impression on people if you try to. If you walk into a room trying to make a good impression, you will fail. You will trip up. It's when you are truly yourself that other people see personality, and that personality coming from God. Submit to death, death of your ambitions, death of your wishes and desires, death of your whole body. In the end, submit every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. C.S. Lewis, who I've been reading again recently, says this: nothing that you've not given away will ever truly be yours. Nothing in you that hasn't died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself, you'll find in the long run only hatred and loneliness and despair, rage, ruin and decay. But look for Christ and you'll find him in everything else. Everything else as well. Now, I want to talk about this truth because it's important. We've given the setting for it. We are caught up in this great battle. We're told to wear the armor of God because we are caught up in this battle. And what I'm trying to do is give some practical advice here, because what I want to suggest is you've got to become that soldier. You can't be the civilian. There is no room for civilians. The belt of truth must get wrapped around you and tied and tightened and fastened, and then it must never be taken off again. You must stay with this eternal truth constantly in mind, otherwise you'll slip back into your ordinary life. Your ordinary life where shopping lists become important and not secondary. The everyday life where what you wear is important as opposed to what you need. I know we're all caught up in it. Don't think I'm trying to preach in that sense. I'm a hypocrite. But what I'm giving you is the truth. The truth that's beyond me that I wish I was. And so some advice. There's an old... I was trying to figure out the name of this fairy tale. Luke and I were talking about the old Grimm fairy tales and talking about them a few weeks ago. And I remember the story, but I don't know where it's from. But the story goes something like this. There is this monstrous character. I think it's a variant of Beauty and the Beast, but who knows. And this monstrous character, and in the fairy tale, they have to stick the mask on. So the hideous features are underneath. And they put the mask on, and they're told they have to wear it for a year. And there's all sorts of other things happen, but the punchline is that at the end of the year, they take the mask off, and guess what? Their face has grown and been shaped to fill the mask. And as the mask is taken away, that which was hideous has been transformed into beauty. Now, I can see a connection here. Let's just go to the beginning of the Lord's Prayer. The very first words are, "Our..." Thank you. Do you see what those words mean, really? You are putting yourself in the place of being a son of God. Why? Because you're saying, "Our Father." You can't say "Our Father" unless you claim, first of all, that you are a son or a daughter. I don't mean this gendered, so please. So actually, there's a verse, and we'll come to it later, but it talks about putting on Christ. To put it bluntly, it's sort of dressing up as Christ. It's in a sense, pretending. Because, of course, you realize instantly, you say, "Our Father," and realize, hang on, I'm saying I'm a son of God. You look at yourself with your, with all of your failings and problems, and you think, oh, you know, I'm the least like a son of God possible. So in that sense, dressing up with Christ is a piece of outrageous cheek. But the odd thing is, that's exactly what he's told us to do. In Romans 13:14, it says, "Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires." Put on Christ. It's telling us, if you like, to do something practical, to try and become, to, and we might say, what's the use of pretending? But actually pretending, there's two types of pretending. There's a bad pretending. And the bad pretending, you know what that's like. When someone gets up and says, "I'm perfect, I'm pretty good, you follow me." And that type of pretending is horrible and bad, yes. But there's a good time as well. There's the pretense that actually becomes important because it shapes us. For example, let's imagine that you're not feeling particularly friendly and you've got guests coming, right? Now, you can be grumpy and offend them and never see them again. But we don't want that. So what happens is we put on a friendly manner. Hello. The trouble is now, anytime I say hello to somebody who comes to our house, you're going to wonder about this. But never mind. Great to see you. Grand to have you around. Give us your hand. Let's have a shake. Big smile. Yay. Now, the funny thing is, within a few minutes, you will notice that you're actually feeling friendlier than you were. And that's a good thing. And it's like, here I am dressing up as Christ. And actually, if we live like that, it's like we're shaping ourselves to the mask. It's like we find in ourselves becoming the sons of God. It's not just a fancy way of saying about conscience, because it's not that. If you simply ask your conscience, you get one result. But if you remember to dress up as Christ, you get a different one. Put on Christ. Tomorrow morning, when somebody upsets you at work, don't wait for your conscience to say you shouldn't do that. Instead, be positive. Put on Christ. Act as Christ would have reacted. Even though you don't feel it, what's feelings got to do with anything? Wear the belt of truth. The real Son of God is at your side, and the incredible thing, he wants to put his life inside you. You might have heard this illustration before, but it's a great illustration. And that is this. Imagine that we are all toy soldiers. And Christ's life wants to come to us and turn that plastic into real living flesh. He wants to turn us. And Christ being formed in us, he wants us to have the mind of Christ. The trouble is, we're obstinate toys. We resist, and we don't want to be turned into what he wants to turn us into. The natural life in us is self-centered, something to be petted and admired, take advantage of other people. But we want to leave that behind. The natural life complains because it wants us to have preeminence. It's afraid of light and air of the spiritual world, just as people who've only known dirt are scared of a bath. Christ wants to turn us from soldiers or Barbie dolls, whoever you played with. He wants to turn us into the real thing. He wants his life to become our life. He wants to make us into the sons of God. But that transformation progress starts with us saying, "Christ, come into my life and save me." But he wants us to become holy. He wants us to become transformed into living like the heritage that we have. Yes, he's done all the work, don't get me wrong. He's died for us. I'm not talking about good works here. What I'm talking about is living and learning to live practically like the sons of God that we've been called to be. And sometimes we've got to start somewhere. And I'm telling you now, why don't you start here? Put on Christ. When we have that idea of somebody trying to transform this toy into flesh, we get a problem. Like, how on earth could that work? But we see what God did was this. The second person of God, the Son, becomes human and born into the world as a real man of a particular height. Don't know how tall he was, of a particular color. Don't know how fair or dark of skin he was. We've got indications, of course. He spoke a particular language. He weighed so many stone kilos. He was real. The eternal being who knows everything and created the whole world not only became a man, but actually just became a fetus that grew. And the result of this is this one man lived the life of what all men were intended to be. And it's this great mystery, but try and stay with it if you can. He was truly man at the same time that he was truly God. I know we know this, but bear with me. And so for the very first time, God and humanity came together. And he chose an earthly career that involved him having to kill off all of his earthly desires along the way. We see him born into poverty. Yeah? God probably was hungry. God knew what it was like to live in dirt. He knew what it was like to be misunderstood by his whole family. He knew what it was like to be betrayed by his intimate friends. He knew what it was like to be jeered at, manhandled by the police, executed and tortured. And I know we often concentrate on the crucifixion because the idea of God suffering in that way for us is incredible. But I'm equally blown away by 30 years of living before then. For 30 years before his ministry, he lived as a human without sinning. He lived not as a plastic toy, but he lived real, undestroyed by inside by sin. He did it. The Bible says he suffered all the same temptations that we have. God tempted. God tempted to murder. How easy it would have been to call down legions of angels upon those who were busy crucifying. God tempted to steal when he was a kid, I'm sure. He was tempted in all things as we are tempted. And so we see him dying upon the cross and importantly, vitally, resurrected. But what we see at this point is incredible because listen. When he's resurrected, it is not just the God part of him that is resurrected, but what? It is the man resurrected too. Paul speaks of the man Jesus in heaven. He rose bodily from the dead. This flesh and blood that was sinless, he didn't just rise as God, but he became permanently tied to a body of flesh. Not only was he man and God when he walked the earth, he is man and God now. Do you understand? Now, get this. Because he did that, something changed for us, for this flesh that we have. This resurrection now reaches out. It's as if, how should we put it? Well, okay, we look at all of us here, all very different. But we can go back to our fathers and our grandfathers and our grandfathers' grandfathers, like this massive tree. But as we go back and go back and go back and go back until we come to the first man, Christ has paid the price for the whole of flesh, the whole of man. And those who look forward to his coming find themselves in glory, even as we do now. What I'm suggesting is this, that the resurrection power now reaches into the toy soldier. We don't have to paint them as if they're flesh. What Christ did was turn us into little Christs. It's right through the word. It describes us as sons of God, not yet seen maybe, but the manifest sons of God will happen. We have been transformed through his perfect, sinless life. We share. And these bodies will be transformed and glorified because of the victory that he won, not as God being resurrected, but as man and God being resurrected. And now Christ has a body in heaven that still has a certain weight and still has a certain height and still has a certain skin color and still has a certain colored hair, because he still exists as a resurrected body in heaven. Oh, well, sorry, I'm getting excited. I know these illustrations are limited. I know they are. But like, I suppose, dropping something into a glass of water that changes the color of everything. It's as if that's what happened with us. Now we are to put on Christ. Because he's promised that we can live in victory. We can live sinless lives. Why? Because he is present within us. He has put his spirit inside us. And we might start with pretense, being nicer than we are or friendlier than we are. But if we live it, we will be. And when we get up tomorrow morning and we live as if we live in this great battle, and we live in as if we're soldiers, and we put on Christ, and we put on the belt of truth, and we put on the armor of God, and we might feel foolish. But friends, if we live it, we will become it. He has transformed humanity itself. Now, I know that prayer is going to be dealt with separately, and I don't want to tread on people's toes. But there's something about this that I've got to deal with. I've said that you find yourself only by surrendering your life to him. And we have a relationship with God in prayer. And it's worth saying this, that we sometimes deeply misunderstand prayer. We are told to pray and petition God for things. Give us this day, Lord, our daily bread. We are meant to ask for things from God. You have not because you haven't asked. But although we petition God with our prayers, and although prayers always promise to be answered, we must understand that it's not necessarily the way we think. Because we will see Christ kneeling on the grass in Gethsemane, where he says, Lord, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And what was the answer? No. Do you get it? We sometimes think that our prayer life is determined by how holy we are. It isn't. We sometimes think our prayer life is determined by how much faith we've got. It isn't. We sometimes think that our prayer life is determined by who we are. If Christ himself could petition his Father and the answer be no, let's have no illusions. But one thing I do want to get into at this point is this. Prayer isn't magic, and prayer is not advice offered to God. But we are called, nevertheless, to spend time with God. And although petition is part of it, Christ wants to speak very much into our lives. Christ wants us to be changed. And when I started this idea of what God did, I had to come to this point of understanding, or trying to understand something else that's tied to it, about this great story. And in 2 Peter 3, in verses 7 to 9, it says this. But the same word, the heavens and the earth that existed are now stored up for fire, have been kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. But don't overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are as one day. I won't read the rest of that. It's a very natural thing for us to think of this. How on earth can God answer our prayers or spend time with us when millions upon millions of other people are petitioning him at this point in time? And I suppose the key word is at this point of time. And I want to suggest that this great story, this great truth, one of the things that's helpful for us to understand is that although our life comes a moment at a time, and then it arrives and leaves, and then the next moment comes along and there's little room for anything in the middle, that is not how God works. You know, 1,000 years is a day. God takes delight in you. You are precious to him. For you, you might spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes in prayer. Maybe you pray for longer. But to God, who knows how long he spends in our perception of time with you. Maybe those few minutes to God seem like a year. He wants us to become the sons of God because he wants us to be like Christ, and he wants to take the same delight in us as he took in his only begotten Son. This is my Son in whom I am well pleased. He utters the word over Christ. But maybe too, we will find there are moments in our lives when he's been looking down on us and had his hand upon us and said the same words, because we need to become like Christ. I know I'm not doing this well. I know I'm not putting it over right. It's very hard when you start to try and do this. We imagine time as a line. We see it starting there and stopping there, but God is the whole page. What I'm suggesting this morning is that the truth is, and the truth we must live by is this, that we are caught up in massive events. We're caught up in a cosmic battle. But I thank God that the battle's already won. I thank God that the enemy is already defeated. And I'm fascinated by the fact that God, when he calls us to live for him, is determined to let us do things that he wants done. And this is why I keep coming back to prayer. He is prepared to let us do the things he wants. And if we don't do them, they won't get done. James said, for example, if you're going to pray for somebody and they've got a need, why don't you just meet the need? You with me? It's like that. We are to become little Christ. We are to become part and parcel of his army. There's so many different illustrations and metaphors crossing over here. But we're not gladiators. We're not people who stand and fight by ourselves. We're soldiers who stand shoulder to shoulder with each other. As Luke talked last week, shield locked with the shield of everybody else here. The battle for Billingham, I don't know where else it lies if it isn't here. The battle for Seton Carew, I don't know where else it lies if it isn't here. God will not call thousands of angels down to evangelize. He's calling you to do it. God will not let manna come from the clouds to feed the hungry. He's given you the job of doing it. God will not necessarily, and I've got to be careful because I don't want to take it too far, but yes, God can comfort somebody, but he also wants you to be the little Christ that goes and comforts them. We are commanded by our great and heavenly captain of our faith. We're not defensive troops. We're attacking troops. My prayer this morning is that you would lose yourself in him. Give yourself to him, totally without reservation. Practically, put on Christ. If you feel not worthy, it doesn't matter. If you feel ugly, wear the mask. Put on Christ. Be transformed because he's promised to transform you. Step up to the plate. Only soldiers can wear the belt. And once the belt's on, it should never be taken off. Realize the truth of your life. Realize the insignificance of things that we get caught up on and so passionate about that matter so little. And the Lord bless you and keep you. Amen.